All right, let's dive in. I want to take you to 77A2. This is the part that I skipped over the last time, but I want to go back a little bit while we're in the midst of figuring out the mekorot, the sources for the different inyea nefesh, that we have these afflictions, and we're trying to discover the various sources for them. We had just talked about the source for washing and anointing. Remember, and you know, whether or not washing was the same thing as anointing, and anointing is the same thing as washing, and soaking for the skin is the same as actually washing of the skin, and is it more like drinking? Was the question of the Gemara is like rubbing something on like drinking? Anyway, I skipped a section here, and 77A2. There's a section because there was a little bit of a kind of a tangent after the notion of finding verses about a verse from Daniel that was Va'ani Vati Bidvarecha. I've come because of your words. And the notion is that we're referencing the book of Daniel, which is a rather interesting book in the sense that it has both Hebrew and Aramaic in the book, and it's in the Tanakh. So from a canonical level, a canonical standpoint, that's a very interesting reality that we have a book in the Tanakh that has both the Aramaic and the Hebrew, because it seemed like the rule for the rabbis, for Chazal, for the sages, was really that, okay, books at least have to be in Hebrew to be in our Tanakh. But here we have a little bit of what's called Yotzei Min HaKlal. It goes a little bit against the grain, against the general principle, against the general rule. We have this book. Why is that also interesting for us at this time of year? Because the book of Daniel comes around the same time as the books of the Maccabees. And of course, the books of the Maccabees are not part of our canon, but I'm going to mention some of that more on Shabbat verses here. That said, there's a reference to the book of Daniel, which is this book about being in exile and not really having Jerusalem in our possession, and not really experiencing the fullness of our culture, of our religious creativity, of our ability to sacrifice on our altar. All of this is wrapped up in the book of Daniel, and the part I just want to show you is that there's some references to angels and references to this whole discussion about being in the land versus not being in the land of Israel. And again, if the notion of the editors of the Gemara of our Talmud, if any part of their notion of their organizational principles are, let's put some curricular material together for Jews who will, subsequent to the formation of the Mishnah, study these passages in order to make richer the experience of the holidays to which these Talmudic passages are attached, and they want us to have a richer experience of Yom Kippur, and that's kind of how we've been reading some of these sources that we've been taking a look at, to really understand the deepness, the depth of the fast, of why these different afflictions. Here, the idea in my read of it, if I'm to take that kind of approach, read it with this lens that they're helping us make meaning of our holiday experiences, what they're doing is they're saying, don't forget, you want to consider where you are celebrating. Are you in Israel or are you in the diaspora? And what do you believe about angels? There's a notion that we go up on our toes during the Kedusha of any Amida, where we're being like angels. The idea that we can be in touch with the world of angels and that the entire world of angels exists by Chazal, by the sages, this is a reality. A world of angels exists. And the host of heaven contains certain angels who are friends of the Jews, if you will, or angels of other nations even, and that other nations of the world also have their angels in heaven that talk to God about those nations and what those nations are supposed to be doing and how they're supposed to be guiding those nations. This is all part of the cosmology of the Talmudic era. And it also becomes part of the curriculum concerning the Yom Kippur experience by way of it being included here. Or at least it's here. And the question is, A, how does this further inform any meaningful understanding of my sitting in the Yom Kippur experience? And B, can we really say that it's connected to that, or is this really just some tangent? You know, I'm into my theory being a Hava Amina, right? You can knock it down. Say, wait a minute, this seems to have nothing to do except that they mentioned the verse and somebody had a tradition about the verse and the editors included it. That's kind of the form criticism answer to my kind of ritual theory read of the Gemara, right? But let's see what it says. I'm on the second column, I'm on the first column closest to the gutter of the page, and Gemara relates the other angel's response. You see it at the bottom there? So let's just go from there. Below hishgichu alav, they paid no attention to Gavriel. They had mentioned Gavriel up top. He had risen from behind a curtain and recited a verse. It is in vain for you who rise early, who sit up late, who eat the bread of sorrows, for so he lives. He was kind of talking about the whole notion of being in Persia. And they're basically saying traditions about what happened during that time when they were exiled. Okay, but they pay no attention to Gavriel. Amar lefanav, Gavriel then said before God, Ribono shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Im yehu kol chochmei umot ha'olam b'chafmos nayim, if all the wise men of the nations of the world were placed in one pan of a balance, right? Remember that ancient or current, whichever balance you're kind of looking at, there are balances for weights and measures, and you have the little...
Scales.
They call those Moznayim. And what's that come from?
Mazan.
It's a balance. You're trying to balance the two sides, right? And what's the root?
Ozin.
Because your ears, you know, the whole effect of the balance, right?
Oh, because they knew that the balance was based on in the ear?
It's an ancient premise. Yeah.
That's amazing.
The notion that someone was affected in there, according to one of those folks who we've talked about before, one of the scholars or another, whether it's Proust or what's your friend's name?
Galen.
Not Galen, but the guy who wrote about Talmudic medicine.
Heller, I think. Is
that the one you know?
I think that the notion of Dr. Rossner, that I think that they trace back that root to the ears because they knew something about the sense of balance could be lost if we didn't have the exact right channeling going on and the system being in sync.
Fred Rossner,
that's it. But Daniel, Ish Chamudo, B'chaf Shnia, and Daniel, the greatly beloved one, were placed in the second pan, okay? So all the wise men of the nations are in one pan of the balance, and Daniel, our prophet, is in the second pan of the balance. Lo nimsa machriya et kulam. Would it not turn out that he outweighs them all? Wouldn't it turn out that our Daniel, our prophet, would outweigh all of these chochamim, all of these sages from the rest of the world? Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, thereupon the Holy One, blessed is He, says, Mi hu zeh shehem milamed zechut abanai? Who is this that's advocating for my children? Which angel is this who's coming to me as their lawyer? The lawyer on behalf of the Jewish people, the lawyer on behalf of Daniel. Who is that? Gavriel, of course, it's Gavriel. Amru lefanav, the angel said before him, Ribono shel Olam, Gavriel, Master of the Universe, it's Gabriel. It's Gabriel. Amar lehem yavo. Thereupon the Holy One, blessed be He, said, let him enter. Shenemar v'ani vati bidvarecha. I came according to your word. It was God's word that said to them, let him enter. I came. So, aliyahu, they brought Gabriel in. Atashkechei ledubio v'nakatle le igartebide. He came and found Dubiel holding in his hand the letter that authorized the Persians to tax the Torah scholars. There he is, Dubiel, who's obviously authorizing the king. and this is this worldly kind of the masters of Torah are oppressed by the government, or at least taxed. Gabriel sought to cast it from his hand. Bala'ah, Padubiel quickly swallowed it. And Ikad Amri, there are those who say, Michtav hava kativa michtav lo hava hotma. The letter was written, or the decree was written, but it wasn't signed. But Ikad Amri, and there are those who say, Af mitche nami hava hotma, and it was signed as well. Kidvale machik la mine. But as he swallowed it, he erased the signature. Hainu devimalchuta defras. This is why the Persian kingdom, ika de yahiv karga, there are those sages who pay the head tax, ika de lo yahiv karga, and there are those who don't.
We started with this fact and worked back.
That's right. No doubt. No doubt. But it could have been angelic.
That's a great explanation.
Right.
And it's found here because...
Now, I want to ask the question, why could it be on Yom Kippur? Let's say, go for a minute with my theory, that a lot of this material comes, even in a discursive way, because they weren't organized in a kind of narrative form. Like, let's talk about only this theme and topic and do all the text. And now let's talk about this theme and topic and we'll organize all the text. And now we'll organize, you know, it's not organized that way. Let's start there. That's not the way they organize it. It's more discursive than that. They connected it to a verse. It's a thread. They mentioned this verse, and now they have this tradition about this verse, and they included it here. They didn't have to include the tradition about the verse here, because there are a lot of traditions about a lot of verses that don't get included wherever other verses are mentioned. So I'm not going to entertain necessarily that that's the reason. I mean, is it the one place the verse is used? We could do some investigating. So let's say, what can we possibly understand from this passage just alone, this small piece of the larger passage about Yom Kippur?
The power of the Jews compared to the other nations, because there it's on a balance.
Right, so you're...
Judgment of God between Israel and the other
nations. Right, so here you're talking about the judgment of God about the Jews, whether it's one person individually, Daniel standing up for, like, you know, the kind of sense, like, oh, who am I? I can't be Daniel, but one of our scholars, one of us versus the world. Don't we have some kind of chosen relationship with God? Don't I have to depend? Can't I depend on that? And versus others, and shall we be, if you will, on that scale, thinking about it like the scales of forgiveness and potential punishment? That's the image we get sometimes with Yom Kippur. Here it's a little different, though, because it's actually talking about the people being judged versus the others of the world, and the portions of the peoples of the world versus our portion. But I think it's in that general vein that it's being brought up. And secondly, what's the angel doing? What's this whole discussion with angels about? That somehow we are to be a little less than angels in that sense on Yom Kippur, and especially because we're shedding the kind of physicalities of the world and all these afflictions that we're talking about over here and over here, kind of couching this conversation, then we're wondering about the kind of, I don't want to overuse the term spirituality, but there's a certain kind of cosmology being introduced here so that one can relate to the world of godliness, the world of the divine. You've shed your physical, you've said, I'm going to take care of the Inui Nefesh, that's a mitzvah on Yom Kippur, and tucked into the material about all those different afflictions is this world of angels and somebody arguing on your behalf.
Gabriel is an angel. Dubiel is also an angel.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's not so known.
He's not so known. And by the way, if there...
What was his job in the universe?
Uh-huh. So he was...
Swallowing documents.
No.
He was a shredder.
Listen to this. Dubiel's job in this setup, in the way that the Gemara is relating to it, is to be the angel who is in charge of the Persian kingdom. He's the one advocating for the Persian kingdom up on high.
We need to talk to him now.
So listen to this. In that we thought about how, you know, whether or not there were such traditions of who is this guy. I was reading what's called Yalkut Be'erim in the larger Mativta Gemara, which is a collection of traditions that we have on each page of the Gemara. Okay, so listen to this. Michael Sar Shel Yisrael. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu leMichael. God talks to angels is going to be this. That's kind of like where it starts. And Gavriel Sar Shel Eish O Shel Mayim. And then this other tradition, he's the master angel for fire and water. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu leMichael. Mifarish Maharsha. The commentator of the Maharsha, who is generally known in the back of traditional Gemaras as a person who likes to take care of commenting on more like legendary agadot and traditions we have, like angelic traditions could be one of them. The Michael, who's Sar Shel Yisrael? So the Maharsha points out that Michael is the ministering angel of Israel. Uchamo shekatu b'pasuk, but Daniel, and like that's written in the verse from Daniel, Michael Sarachem. So when it says that Michael is your
agent,
he's the ministering angel of Israel. The Hikshua Mefarshim. But the commentators have a little bit of problems with this, a little bit of a problem with that tradition. Ech efshar lomar shemichael hu hatsar shel Yisrael. How can you really say that Michael is the ministering angel of the Jewish people? V'hadarei amru b'zohar, because he's reading now material that comes into formation, literary material that comes into formation. We're talking maybe some of it is coming around the European theater in chapbooks and small scrolls. You know, the whole notion of the Zohar and how it gets put together into all its literary form is really fascinating. But the Zohar is a European production, mystically inclined, exploring traditions that seem to, you know, like creation ex nihilo. Some people say, like, oh, they just created this whole language. But that's not really the case. We've already been afforded great insight into that whole world of the Zohar being formulated and expressing older mystical theories and relating to topics that are more mystically inclined topics that don't get fleshed out in, let's say, traditional capital R rabbinic literature, and that they really did have their roots much earlier. So some of the Zohar's traditions could be, especially about the world of angels, that we know from some ancient texts, there is a world of angels that people obviously understood. Ezekiel sees them, you know, traveling through the sky, and here in Daniel we have the angels being mentioned. So these are the angels, at least the commentators, who know some of those other traditions and now have the Zohar to crystallize what we believe about angels in our tradition. It says, Eich efshar lomar shemichael hu hasar shel Yisrael. How can we say Michael is the ministering angel of Israel? The harei amru v'zohar shedrak shivim umot hen tachat mem shelet hasarim ha'elyonim. That the tradition has it that only the 70 nations of the world, which is the way of expressing all of the other peoples of the world, only those 70 nations actually have ministering angels on high. Shekol uma yesh la malach hamemuna aleha. Every nation has a specific angel assigned to it. So when you ask, who's Dubiel? We could see from the past, obviously, Dubiel is the advocate for Persia.
So there are 70 angels?
So there are at least, right? Because if there are 70 nations, there are 70 angels, according to that tradition. And if there are more than 70 nations, there are even more angels.
I was once told that the word 70 just means a lot.
So there are those who say it's exact, and they'll argue l'chalutin, you know, that really this one who believes that they're different than that one, you have to lump them together, you know, and so there are some of these histories that are created with people who are more, you know, conservative, small c, about 70 versus the reality that it's a multiplex of nations on the face of the earth. And the Zohar tradition will go further and say, but Aval Yisrael, but Israel, Einam tachat memshelet hasarim, Eila hem chelko shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But Israel doesn't have necessarily a ministering angel because, and it's a really interesting Hebrew expression, hem chelko shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They are the people assigned to God.
No, part of God.
No, chelko is like his, in this case, like that we are the Yerusha. Instead of calling us an inheritance, we are God's chelek in the world. We are God's beloved people. So, you know, my chelek.
So why we need an agent to talk to God?
Well, that's exactly what the Zohar is saying.
Yeah, we can talk to God.
That's exactly what
we
mean.
We don't have one.
You mean why did Gabriel have to speak?
Why would Gabriel or Michael?
Oh yeah, back to the Gemara. If that's the tradition, why did? But now we can understand what the Gemara was saying. Who's this talking on behalf of Israel?
We don't need one.
Did they hire one of my guys? You know what I mean? Like it was the surprise here is because of the Zoharic tradition that's recorded. But
the Talmud is much earlier than the Zohar.
Right, and that's what one of the things that I'm bringing out is that when we studied Zohar this summer and when we read Moshe Idel on the Zohar, and when we think about the Zohar, people say, ex nihilo, it comes from nothing. Ah, but I think that it's actually, if you take this Zohar that I just quoted you, that's brought up by the Mefarshim in the Yalkut here, and you look at what we just read in the Gemara, it's really wonderful. You see in the Talmud this wonderful tradition, this fantastic, I mean, fantastic in fantastic, like the realm of the fantasy in fantastic, the realm of the deeply cosmologically reality, the angelic reality that exists, that it's Talmudic. And that what the Zohar might be doing is giving a concrete way of understanding what Talmudic mindset was vis-a-vis angels, which is exactly why God could ask. And I love this question, you know, like, who is this? Amar Kodesh Baruch Hu, mi hu zeh milamed zechut al banai? Like, al banai, they're my children. I'm supposed to be giving them zechut, and yet I have an angel who's coming in and acting like their agent.
Do we get this in the Yerushalmi or only in the Zohar?
It's a good question. I didn't do the parallel work yet, but we should look. Because I wonder if in Eretz Yisrael or in Babylonia, the angelology is very different. A good friend during rabbinical school was I think he's now the Hillel director at Harvard, Rabbi Jonas Steinberg. And he was writing on angelology in the tradition and perhaps was looking at, if I'm remembering correctly, some of the differences between Eretz Yisrael and Bavli. So we should be specific and say, here in the Talmud Bavli, it's saying that. So we'll leave open the question. I don't know what's in the Yerushalmi.
Is there a short answer to the question, because if it's not, we can do it later, of why we have downplayed angels later on in Judaism? It's very long.
No, it's not very long. What's beautiful about the traditional Siddur is that we haven't downplayed it at all. And what's really cool is that every time we get together for Minyan, we're basically reliving angelic experience. So I could make this it could be a really great class to see every spot in the Siddur, and we could do a whole semester about it. But I want to, your question's wonderful because it's so pertinent to this inyan. Because it happens on Yom Kippur, because it happens every day. We in the very, you know, when the first time we say Kadosh, 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 Va'ofanim v'chayot ha-kodesh v'ra'ash gadol mitnasim l'umat serafim, the angels that appear as beasts in the sky, and the hosts of heaven that are flurrying, present in the court, in the heavenly court, part of the fantastic array of beings in whose midst you are now praying, like they are, chanting and offering praises of the Holy One. They have said Kadosh, 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 and so should you now. We say Kadosh, 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 using chapter 11 of Isaiah as the liturgical yet prophetic quotes to relive the experience of sensing what the angels are saying, which is Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. And then you get to the Amida, and the same thing in the Kedusha. You're literally re-experiencing what Isaiah says in chapter 11 is the hosts of heaven experience and practice on a daily level.
So, Shivim HaMalachim, they don't belong to us. So why they say Kadosh, 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 we are part of God.
Maybe that's a whole different host. Maybe so those, maybe those 70 are assigned, and they have specific jobs, and can still do the rest of the time, the kind of praises, song, all kinds of work that God needs to have happen in the heavens, or they're a separate group. These are explorations that in angelology in our tradition, people were willing to explore with no capital P proof to be made, right? Because this is an exploration, a spiritual exploration.
Yeah, just a follow-up question. And again, just if it's just a short answer. So it's not only in parts that are only with in Minyan, in the Tefillah, that we have the angelic
correct
experience? It's not only in parts.
Correct.
Correct,
it's not.
Okay.
And it's part of the liturgy of the first bracha, before the Shema,
uh-huh,
particularly there. It's all connected in.
But it's also a physical representation of this, because the Holy of Holies has two cherubim exactly at the point where God's presence is. So that imagery is, that at least to me, has always been that those cherubim, angel-like figures, mm-hmm, are really the point. Well, not so much, in my view, not so much the guardians, but the point of contact, so that those whatever they are represent the connector,
right,
that stratifies the universe in terms of the heaven and God and us down here, and the intersection point is physically made to reflect that reality.
The possibility that you could create a throne of God's presence, or a space for God's presence in a physical kind of constructed art piece or part of the temple ritual items, right? Very much was on the mind of ancient creators in terms of potential God experience.
But that's Torah. I mean,
that's Torah.
That's Torah.
Whether
that's
or not it, what's the question in what you're, you know, kind of conceiving of, is whether or not those kruvim, those cherubim, were originally intended to be the same as malachim,
yeah,
or malachei asharet, or the angels that are named in Daniel. Are they, in a certain sense, other than, if they are, why do they, on the physical plane of existence, merit to have the indwelling presence of God, at least the Shekhinah,
yeah,
or otherwise the presence of God there? And we can explore, based on different traditions of what the Kruvim really were and what they represented, the potential that they merit that because of either an angelic connection that they have to the hosts of heaven, or to some other aspect of creation because they are physically manifest as part of our temple accoutrement. So what do they represent? I'll just give you one example. One theoretical discussion about them once led to thinking about them as a representation of youth in their own right, right? Because they're always pictured very, like young, you know, the faces are full of youth. And that it could be the notion that, you know, this kind of where we sense God the most is the growth of a human being from this to this. Another is, no, wait, weren't they supposed to be more wisdom faces, whatever you want to call wisdom faces, older with wisdom, even if they're youthful, kind of full of wisdom. And we don't think about them being childlike at all. That's kind of a recreation of what they were originally about. So there are many explorations of what they could have really been like. Obviously, we don't know because we never found the originals. And we have to think very deeply about whether or not they fit into the scheme of angels or they don't, because they're really never called angels per se.
They didn't have any other job, the cherubim. The cherubim never had any other job except overlooking
right.
the Kodesh HaKodeshim.
Right. Or the Ark itself. So just to mention what Jay mentioned in the midst of the conversation, the other place where angels come in daily, for those who recite it, is quoting Jacob's blessing to the children that says that angels should be on your right and your left and above your head and behind you. And those are Mimini Michael, so Michael on your right, Ulis Moli Gabriel on the Umilifanai Uriel, the angel of light over here, Uriel, if you want to take his name's meaning at least. Umeacharai Raphael, and after me, Raphael, the angel of healing. Ve'al Roshi Shechinarel, and above us is the indwelling presence of God. And that liturgy is recited as part of, at least in the Ashkenazic rite, because I can't remember right now, I think it is as well in the typical Sephardic, that you have the angels mentioned by name, in those four angels mentioned by name in the bedtime Shema.
So what I should do one time is, it'd be really interesting, bring you some Renaissance paintings that have a real, not just boutique, the entire congregation of heaven, and it's Christ, but around Christ are different spheres of angels. Mm. And it must be taken from Jewish, all of this, the Jewish part, to see how, what they read and whether or not they got it right in terms of the whole array of heavenly angelic presence. Because painted, I mean, there's a whole register of heaven. There's earth below, and then there's heaven, and there's God, and there are angels that are arrayed with different colored wings and things, and it must be from these descriptions.
Well, for sure we began those descriptions. I'm not exactly sure which descriptions those painters would have used, maybe
so
since the church.
Know, you know
so some of them, for sure this is a fantastically expansive literature in and of itself in terms of the folks who tried to create schematics of what the hosts of heaven contained, which angels were there. Some of our earliest angel texts, recognizing that in the Torah and in the Talmud we have angel traditions, but some of our texts that then go beyond and explore what angels' jobs are in terms of interactions with them for typical Jews down below are mystical texts called Merkavah texts that have angels as guides who guide us through layers of heaven. And the desire is to be able to ascend with them to really come as close to the throne room of God as possible. And then Middle Ages, we wind up having all these angels in Heichalot literature, in, again, a different kind of palace and spheres of divinity literature, where the angels are just sailing us on up into the heavens. So it's very much alive in the tradition. Let me just read a little bit more of what happens here in the typical ways, though, that your question bespeaks a certain kind of attitude that perhaps, though, we don't want to get so deep into all of this, despite the fact that we just spent a little time exploring a bunch of it. Umitareitzar Ramban, the Ramban, Nachmanides, explains the following. Shemichael lo hayasar memuneh v'shalit al Yisrael. He wasn't really the one who was assigned to Israel and really was the advocate on behalf of Israel. Eila sar misharet ha'omed levakesh rachamim aleihem. But he did serve as an advocate to request mercy for them whenever it was necessary. Uchamo hamalach shenigle Yoshua sheba l'sayei l'Yisrael b'milchamtam. Like when it says that Joshua, when Joshua needed help, and an angel came to help in the wars that they were in, the battles that they were waging. Ve'od mivayer haRamban, and Nachmanides makes further clarification. Shebichinat zu shel Yisrael shehem b'hanhagato shel Hakadosh Baruch Hu bilvad. And so he says, and really you have to understand that the Jewish people really is connected to God, and God is their, you know, kind of guiding presence. Hayta v'ikar v'eretz Yisrael. But that's, in essence, when they're in the land of Israel. She'eretz Yisrael hi ha'aretz ha'miyuchedet l'hashkachato shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Because Eretz Yisrael is the land that is connected to his guidance and his indwelling presence and his really being the one attentive to the needs of Israel. The land that God's eyes are upon. But at the time of the diaspora reality, Efshar Shahaya Gam B'Yisrael Inyan Memshelet Hasarim Ha'el Yonim. Then, when you're living in the diaspora, that's when you need the angelic law firm, and they're going to have to advocate for you. So angels naturally would be inclined to advocate, and especially Michael, who is the one who's going to request mercy, and Gabriel, who's Sar HaMemuneh al HaEsh, he's kind of there on the fire and on the water, and if you merit that you know, you're ultimately going to have Gabriel come and help you as well, who's helping God control the world, and therefore your actions within it, you know, will be seen by the ones who are really rulers of the earth and the elements, and can help you kind of achieve this place of greatness before God.
So what you tell us is that built in our history from the beginning, we knew that we would be in the Galut more time than in Israel, because we already prepared angel lawyers group to take care of us.
That's right.
So that's basically what you're telling us.
That's right.
If I were going to, based just on this limited information, make an inference based on what you just said, I would think that maybe we'll find fewer angels in the Yerushalayim.
Right, I mean, that could be the inference.
That's good. I don't know if he's...
If the Ramban is kind of basing himself in this reality, but I'm not sure that where he's taking it from. But I thought it fascinating to just share a little bit about that history and, the notion that we would see this come up in the Talmud was fascinating to me.
When is the first time that angel mentioned in the Torah?
Abraham.
Abel, the man who comes to Abraham.
Yeah,
the word Malachus
was
with Abraham.
Sarah was the three.
You have to remember that for the rabbis, the first time that the angels are mentioned is back in Bereishit, at the beginning of the creation story, when it says, Naaseh et Adam b'tzalmenu. Let's make man in our image.
So that is a really organic part of our...
So the rabbis see that, and they say, hey, wait a minute, who's this, what's this Naaseh? What's this we shall make? What's this in our image? Kidmutenu. That's obviously the hosts of heaven,
right,
speaking
and
with God, God speaking.
The Nephilim.
Right. So what do you make of those? We have these fallen presents, right? Aren't they? Because the root of that word is to fall down to the earth.
So they had to come.
So is the are the Nephilim our agent?
I mean, that's also, if you want to read some of the sources, we could have a wonderful shiur about Mi Ele HaNephilim. Do they have angelic properties? Are they angels themselves who came? And you know, since the Shoresh was that they fall, are they falling from heaven? Then that's definitely one possibility.
They only chose the nice women.
You know, the other possibility by way of that Shoresh is that they were so corrupt that they were called Nephilim, and they were Ki'ilu giants, right? And they, you know how somebody can create for himself, or we'll leave it at himself, a towering reputation of evil? That they've fallen, right? Because the notion that you can be so fallen out of God's grace, out of God's presence, you could be fallen by way of sin and sullied yourself in that reality. That's why the Gemara will say in Brachot, we don't have a nun in the Ashrei Psalm. Because we wouldn't want to say that the Jewish people are at all associated with that letter, nun. With that falling from God's grace. You know? Okay. What do you think? Let's take it back down to earth. Now that we've been in that realm of the host of heaven for a while. And we're going to go to 77:8-3. And we're going to go on the left side down at the bottom, seeks a source for the fourth prohibition. I need to grab one thing from over here that I didn't get before. If I got it. Okay. See at the bottom, I'm on the left-hand column? A source for the fourth prohibition cited in the Mishnah. Unilata sandal minalan. So where do I know about the tradition of shoes? Now, I say the tradition of shoes because the Gemara is not sure what exactly we mean by the Ni'ilat Sandal. It's going to explore what this means. By the way, what do we say now about shoes for Yom Kippur? No leather, right? So listen to the Gemara in terms of what the Gemara is debating about. It's very interesting. It's written like this, V'David ole b'malei hazeitim. And David was going up the Mount of Olives. Ole uvoche v'rosh lo chafui hu olech yachef, crying as he ascended the mountain with his head covered and going barefoot.
Rosho lo chafui. Rosho lo, I'm sorry, you're right.
Okay. Yachef mimai. From what was David bare? Lav menilata sandal. Is it not that he was barefoot and deprived of wearing shoes? In other words, was he not wearing any shoes at all? Now, what's the, just in terms of where the Gemara is going, what's the possibility, al pi halacha now, according to Jewish law, that we could possibly arrive to, that the affliction, that the affliction is going barefoot?
On the rocks.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. Everybody's got to climb the Mount of Olives now, barefoot. Let's go. On Yom Kippur. V'dilma misusia umartika. But perhaps David was bare of a horse and a whip. In other words, he was wearing sandals, but what he lacked was a horse and a whip. So don't tell me it's about the shoes. The Gemara says like this, Eila Amarav Nachman Bar Yitzchak Mehacha. So if we derive that the term bare means barefoot from, if we can't derive that the term barefoot means barefoot from that pasuk, from that verse about King David, how about this other verse?
Does the word in Hebrew bare, could that mean without a horse and also without shoes?
Well, that's what the Gemara is exploring.
I know, but you know that word.
Yeah, but at this point, Bobby, I would say like this. It doesn't... I don't want to say behoove, like it's very close to the hoof. It right now the Gemara doesn't know the word. Like, so if we knew it, it doesn't. It's not admitting.
What they know.
It's not admitting to knowing what it really means. Right now, we're playing with the possibility of meaning, right? So the possibility for the first read was that it means barefoot. The next response to that was, but maybe it means that it was just bare of, because yachef, which means bare, which does, in our parlance today, mean barefoot. But maybe back then it just meant he was going bare, meaning he didn't have his horse.
But even in modern Hebrew, it's from the word chaf. So chaf mipesha, chaf mikavana, it's lack of something.
Lack of something.
Even Hebrew words make
sense. Yeah.
It could be lack of clothes.
Right. So it could be lack of lots of stuff. But here the Gemara is, you know, trying to figure out, does it mean no shoes or does it mean no horse? And so Rav Nachman, who kind of accepts this, has to, though, say, well, wait a minute, I know that there's something with Yom Kippur that, quote-unquote, doesn't have to do with a horse. So I'm going to find a source about shoes over here. Lech ufitachtas. Sak me'al motnecha v'nalcha ta'alotz me'al raglecha. Go and release your sackcloth from your loins and remove your shoes from your feet. This is when Isaiah is commanded to remove clothing and shoes to demonstrate to captives of Egypt and Cush that they'll be led away naked and barefoot by the Assyrian captors.
Interaction with God, the burning bush.
Moses.
Moses.
Yeah. Right. So he takes his shoes off.
Yeah, but that's a different world, the sha'al.
Right.
It's a different, they are not using
take off your sandals.
World.
The verb there is about taking off the sandals.
It's a different,
Uchativ. And he also says it's written like this. V'ya'as ken alo charon v'yachef, and he did so going naked and bare. Yachef mimai, bare of what? Lav minilat sandal? Is it not from taking off the sandal? In other words, the only thing it can mean is not wearing shoes. The Gemara challenges the interpretation. V'ema ben alim amitulaim, but say that yachef doesn't mean that Isaiah went entirely barefoot, but that he went with patched shoes. In other words, really kind of
shmatas
on your legs. In other words, sometimes, right, sometimes you wrap up with old clothing, you make shoes out of them, or you have what look like today that they sell for $40-some-odd, a couple of pieces of cloth stitched to a little bit of rope, whatever, you know, kind of sandals we're talking about. Because if you don't say this, right, if you maintain that it has to be mamash bare, completely bare, arom mamish, then it means that naked actually has to be all the way naked. Rather, naked most certainly means that Isaiah went with tattered clothing because no one's going to be led completely naked through the streets. Here too, then bare means he just went with what we call patchy shoes. He went with the shmata shoes. That's what we said. So, Ela Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, rather Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak says the following, Mehecha, we derive that Yachef means barefoot from here. Now, why? The question is, why are they trying to prove so diligently that it means barefoot?
Because that's what we want to do on Yom Kippur, no?
Well, we know we're not supposed to wear leather. We know that's the law that
nowadays.
We know. Ah, right. So let's open our minds to the fact, or to the possibility, that really we're talking about, just like we had the tax collector and we started from there and we had the story, maybe we're talking about a ritual reality where they went barefoot.
But I'm having trouble understanding what gives this particular phrase about King David all of this authority.
Well, so far that did not get the authority. They seek to prove the notion that barefoot comes from this verse of Yachef, from the David pasuk. Then, since that's kind of accepted as a refutation, the notion that he went without a horse and a whip, he brings another about from Isaiah. And Isaiah, the verse from Isaiah then comes and says, he said Yachef and Aron. And that's got to be completely barefoot, right? And the Gemara says, well, wait a minute. If you say that Yachef means completely barefoot, you've got to also say that Aron means completely naked. And I don't think that anyone was making prisoners walk completely and entirely naked, and therefore you really can't prove to me that Yachef means completely barefoot at this point. And
they're just looking for the source.
Right, they are.
They're already given, the facts are given now.
Right, I think that a lot of times the search for the source is, let's try this possibility, let's try that possibility. I'm not sure that the question is, I have an idea about how we should perform this ritual, let's try to find a verse
to
instruct us. Sometimes, could you see that work being done? Yeah, maybe. But a lot of times it's, I want to know from where we get the source to inform what we do.
People walking on rocky, dust, dirt roads must have felt very afflicted without good things on their feet.
It's good for a flat foot, When if somebody has a flat foot, you should walk like that and it fixes legs.
Well, it was a kind of affliction, I think, though, too. Yeah.
There are people now, we listen to this book on tape about human evolution and the self-fulfilling prophecy about shoes, because there's a whole movement for running barefoot.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And, the notion...
The book Born to Run.
No, it's a different one about evolution.
But he's the one that started that. He went into Mexico to try to find this tribe that lived in the canyon that ran barefoot with very thin soles. And he couldn't run 3 miles without having a problem. But the end of the book was he's running 100 miles with no problems by running barefoot.
Right. But they make a little callus.
So that's the point, is that by running barefoot, your foot adapts with calluses so that you can run barefoot. When we put shoes on and lose our calluses, we lose our ability to run barefoot. So obviously we started out running barefoot. We didn't start running with shoes on day one, for sure. So we must have had the ability to run barefoot. Because that's probably one of the biggest advantages we had in evolution. So this is really, if you will, a self-infliction of civilization, is the loss of the ability to, in fact, function well barefoot.
We know they had sandals.
I wonder, if the return to an experience of barefootedness for a day, in terms of people who experience the affliction, or what we inflicted upon ourselves.
So now it's an affliction because we're not used to it.
Yeah, now because it goes the other way. But I wonder if it gets you in touch in this kind of sense of where it stems from, that you had sometimes to go back to, if it was that they were going back on a Yom Kippur day, to kind of that primordial state of where we started, right? Right, that it goes back to this original notion of being part of the tribe of the universe from whom it all started, right? And Adam is the first. Remember that Adam is the first, according to some Midrashic tradition, to sacrifice to our God, to the God of the universe.
Recorded, but he gets clothes, but he doesn't get shoes.
Right, right. Where did I put my sneakers? I left them in the garden.
I get clothes, but not shoes.
But when your toes do a lot of balancing and everything, and without shoes, you can really grip with toes and get a better connection to the earth.
Yeah,
you can be stable. So, what Jews that live in Africa or in northern Africa and lives in villages that they go barefoot on Yom Kippur, what they do?
They have to put on shoes.
They need to put shoes.
Right, they got to put on shoes that hurt.
That is easy to find. Let's listen to where it goes. Still trying to prove it. So, Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak, Mehacha, why don't you use this verse? Min iraglech meyachef ugronech mitzima. Withhold your foot from barefootedness and your throat from thirst. It's a verse from Jeremiah. Meaning etzmech minachet, that is, withhold yourself from sin, right? So he's reading it metaphorically, mini raglech miyachef, withhold your foot from barefootedness means to kind of don't do any sins. Kedei shelo yavo raglech liyidei yichuf, so that your feet will not come to barefootedness, meaning when you're taken into exile, you won't be dragged out. And Mini l'shonech midvarim b'teilim, withhold your tongue from idle words, k'dei shelo yavo gronech lidei tzima, so that your throat will not come to thirst, meaning that you'll be so, you know, devoid God in your life if you're speaking in such idle words that you'll literally be thirsty, right? Tzama nafshi le'elohim chai, the psalm says, my soul thirsts for the living God. So you'll be so thirsty if you have that.
Keep yourself from sin, meaning if you eventually Yom Kippur goes away, and if you're not, because they're talking about thirst and barefootedness,
in other words, it will
be necessary. You keep
yourself from sin, these things don't. Right. And that, I think, is a deep connection to the other affliction mentioned in this verse. And that's why they kind of like this verse. I think that's why that's going to end right here. Because it kind of really does talk to you about these. You see that though Yachef does not connote wearing patched shoes, but being totally barefoot in the manner of captives being led into exile, says our Gemara here. And we can say that the case of King David is that his affliction of Yachef also means barefoot, if we know now from this last verse that it means barefoot. And accordingly, one of the five verses mandate affliction on Yom Kippur refers to don't wear shoes. But you might say, that's not our law.
Yeah, no.
So what happens? So we're accustomed to wearing comfortable shoes. And what we don't want to do is we don't want to be comfortable, just like this was uncomfortable. So the notion of what it's supposed to invoke becomes the more relevant to the Yom Kippur experience inyan in Jewish law.
You know, when you take, yeah.
And we wind up getting laws that deal with the reality that we did to ourselves, this kind of wearing shoes reality, and we can't run 100 miles barefoot. We can't run. We can't even walk. Just if you let me, we can't even walk to shul barefoot. We don't have the ability to navigate through the little bit of the garbage heap, the unsanitary conditions, the cold outside, the name it. There's all kinds of issues that come along with being barefoot. Now, were there people who went barefoot for a while based on kind of leaving the Gemara where it is right now and kind of sensing where that is? Well, halachic history about the notion of wearing shoes is something that we're going to look at. But what was the...
When I lived on Kibbutz Nechayam as a kid, we used to always... It's a beach community. I never remember myself wearing shoes. I was only when I went back to Haifa, I put my shoes on. Four months at a time, barefoot all the time.
Was that on Yom Kippur?
That was summertime, so it wasn't Yom Kippur. It was always between June to the end of August or something.
So listen to this wonderful blog entry. May one wear Crocs on Yom Kippur? By Rabbi Shlomo Brody, excerpted in his new book, A Guide to the Complex, Contemporary Halachic Debate.
Better than the Guide to Crocs.
Right. And which color can you wear? And the permissibility of wearing comfortable non-leather shoes on Yom Kippur has been much talked about over the last several years, following proclamations by Rabbis Yosef Shalom Eliashiv and Rabbi Yaakov Ariel, among others, which strongly discouraged the wearing of Crocs on Yom Kippur. Despite the brouhaha, this debate is actually a continuation of a millennia-old discussion regarding the prohibitions of Yom Kippur. The Torah never specifies which actions are forbidden on Yom Kippur. Five times the Bible states that a person should afflict himself, which we're now totally familiar with, in addition to refraining from the work that is forbidden on Shabbat. Unlike the medieval Karaites, for whom affliction included wearing sackcloth and ashes, abstaining from sleep, and other deprivations, the sages limited the term to five areas of self-denial: bathing, anointment, sexual relations, donning shoes, and nourishment, eating and drinking, with the latter seen as the most severe prohibition, whose violation was punishable by spiritual banishment, karet. Some scholars believe that despite the affliction, an element of festive joy is also mandated, as on other holidays, which we discussed. Mentioned in the Torah, in addition to dressing nicely, we recite the Shehecheyanu. Mourners even halt their seven-day bereavement practices, no Shiva. Nonetheless, most scholars understood the day to be uniquely lacking in holiday festivities. The goal might afford certain leniencies with respect to activities that are clearly not intended for pleasure. The Talmud, for example, allows people to rinse dirt from their body, which we're going to get into, and wash their hands after using the bathroom. So this is like the foreshadowing for the next section. An interesting debate exists regarding actions that alleviate discomfort. Many decisors permitted the use of snuff, for example, which some considered an appropriate way to mark the festivity of the day. Excuse me. This was printed out for me, and only the first page made it printed, so we're going to have to do a little bit of finding the remainder.
I always found the snuff thing very
simple. Why would snuff...
Have I seen it?
No. I went to synagogues that use snuff on Shabbat and on certain holidays, and it kind of wakes you up. It's got this wintergreen, you know, like a kind of wintergreenish.
It'll make you more aware.
Yeah, and it makes you more aware. So when you're falling off to sleep, the gabbai comes over and he goes,
okay.
He opens it up and he says, use your pinky, and you sniff it in.
In Karasau, the shul is sand. So to go on Yom Kippur barefoot, it's fun.
Here it is.
Okay, here we go.
When I was a kid, the women in the women's section had an orange with clothes in it. Sniff it in order.
That's
to be
the same difference without the nastiness of tobacco.
They were like ready to faint or something, and they would.
Yeah.
I remember.
First time I ever did snuff was at the Aleppo Synagogue in Nahalol, in Israel. I mean, I didn't know what it was, so they had to explain to me. Contrary to popular belief, the Talmud never explicitly limits the ban on footwear to leather shoes. The Mishnah states a blanket prohibition with a parallel Tanaitic text further forbidding socks. We saw that. The only explicit exceptions are for cases of illness, inclement weather, or walking in hazardous areas. Well, so there, right there we could stop, right? Like, our lives are it's so hazardous. However, some sages covered their feet in reeds or rags. Some understand that these rabbis limited the prohibition to formal shoes, rendering all other protective devices permissible. Others, however, allowed such footwear only if one's foot still felt discomfort from the ground. Anything providing greater protection was disqualified. So just about a matter of discomfort. The dispute continued into the medieval era with Maimonides and others requiring one's foot to feel the ground, while others, followed by Yosef Karo, forbade only footwear made of leather or wood. Now, where would Maimonides be based? Right here. And so, in order to understand Maimonides sometimes, who says, I am translating the Gemara for you, reader, who can't learn. I understand we have, you know, a problem with literacy. Really, I believe that that's our Gemara right now, and Maimonides' opinion about this area of law. But the Shulchan Aruch, Yosef Karo, who's the Tzafat-based Rebbe in Israel, who's writing based on experience of Sephardic reality moving its way east and then into Israel, and understands that and hopes that his code will be circulated, and it winds up getting circulated more in a more popular way because of its size and some of the other kind of printing issues that are along with it. Wonderful story. He realizes that Jews are going to have to take up this notion of being protective, right? And there is where he forbade only footwear made of leather or wood. Despite the latter normative ruling, many prominent figures, including Rabbis Yisrael Meir Kagan and Rabbi Yechiel Michael Epstein, deemed it meritorious to wear slippers or soft-soled shoes in which one feels the ground. While Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik also discouraged padded sneakers, Rabbi Moshe Sternbuch further suggested that any regularly worn comfortable shoes should not be donned on Yom Kippur. Despite these sentiments, the widespread practice, as noted by Israel's chief rabbi during the recent Crocs controversy, is to wear any type of non-leather shoe. So, what I do, on a personal note, the Crocs controversy.
Easy to figure this one out.
A rag. I don't wrap up in rags. I have a pair of Vans, which is a type of sneaker, Vans, that instead of having an arch in it and instead of having a nice soft foam bottom, has a very flat bottom. For me, there's a little bit of, let's say, self-infliction wearing those shoes all day.
Yeah, I find them very uncomfortable. For me to wear something that flat with no heels,
yeah,
and how thin the soles.
And I will say that this year, not to get too personal, but I felt it more than ever on my feet.
You say you can't wear your orthotics.
So, right, I don't have any orthotics there. I don't have a nice, comfortable kind of sneaker. I don't have... I used to wear Tevas. So those were like nice sandals that had and they got over the years, instead of having really flat bottoms, they got more sophisticated by way of how shoes go. And they have now sculpted bottoms. It almost looks like a Vibram sole on a Teva sandal. So I went to these very flat Vans. But I do think that the notion that we have some degree of simcha in that day, as we've discussed before, of joy, and it's Yom Kippur, and the cleansing, and from this, we see, like, there was a real, and this is where, instead of sitting out in the cold and freezing to death, there is a little bit woven in here about what you should feel. You should feel. And where what are you to feel? You're to feel connected to this earth. And as opposed to the angelic texts that I brought at the beginning of this class, and the notion of soaring on high to that realm of the spiritual and the angelic, there's a real down-to-earth, put your feet on the ground, even if your head's up in the spiritual clouds, and understand who you are, understand what sins you carry, understand how you're going to stop your lips from speaking idly, understand how you're going to stop your feet from wandering into the wrong kinds of venues and wandering into situations in which sin is apparent. And so we have the full out play of what the kind of sandal represents, the shoe represents. It's very down to earth physical. There's a ethical reality based on the last verse that they use to explore it with both the lips and the feet and where they carry you. And that coupled with the angel text, we have the entire dimensionality of Yom Kippur come into focus, and the power of the holiday even more through this curricular material for us in the chapter. Happy Hanukkah!
Thank you. Chag Sameach.
Thank you for your patience, class. For sure.